As the coronavirus spreads, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sends out its special agents.
They're the subject of movies often, so they're the disease detectives you often see investigating in movies like Contagion and others.
We look at the global coordinated response to the coronavirus. Also, swarms of locusts are threatening food supplies in Africa and Asia.
A swarm of locusts, the minute it lands in a field, within hours, it can eat almost everything.
A big swarm can quickly eat the food stocks of 35,000 people. And from down under, some good news.
Have a look at this. Water, water, water. Everywhere.
At last, welcome relief from the bushfires that have scorched Australia. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us this Friday. A whistleblower has turned into a hero in China, and Beijing faces a dilemma. Li Wenliang was a doctor in Wuhan, the center of the coronavirus outbreak in China, and raised the alarm about the virus back in December. But police reprimanded him for spreading rumors. Li did not stop sharing information about the sickness he was seeing. Then Li himself caught the virus. He died early this morning in China. His father, Li Shuyin, spoke to the BBC.
He was not spreading rumors. The virus was out there. He sent the message initially only to his friends and family. He was not spreading rumors. I hope the government will withdraw the reprimand. What my son said has now proved to be true.
It can be dangerous to speak out in China, but millions are speaking out about Li online and on the streets of places like Beijing.
I deeply regret his death and feel sincerely sad for him. We need to see if the impact of his death can shake up anything. I hope he did not die in vain.
He left us when we needed him to fight the virus, and he was a victim of it too. In the meantime, he was criticized and unfairly treated because of his report, so we feel very sad and regretful.
He was the first one who found out about the virus, but he then received a reprimand from the police. I think people still don't have enough sense of the potential threat from this virus.
Remarkably, those speakers also gave their names. The government has been accused of delaying the news of Dr. Li's death or covering it up. But at a news conference in the capital, a spokeswoman for the Chinese Health Commission insisted the authorities had battled to save him.
Dr. Li Wenliang from Wuhan died from pneumonia caused by novel coronavirus during the fight against the epidemic. After a great effort to save him, unfortunately, he passed away. The National Health Commission expresses its deep sorrow, and we send our heartfelt condolences to his family.
Yacho Wang has been keeping track of the comments on Chinese social media about the death of Dr. Li. Wang is a China researcher at Human Rights Watch. She told me what she's been reading online.
Just outpouring sadness and altered towards the government's handling of the crisis was just so obvious. I haven't seen this level of anger in many years. So I think people are very angry with the government for, you know, initially hiding information from the public and punishing people who try to raise awareness about the issue. So you can just see how people have all this pent-up anger and now they're, you know, really venting out.
And the Chinese government stepped in to try to shut down the conversation on Weibo. What was Beijing actually able to do?
It's so clear. I mean, there are so many messages and then they're like gone in minutes. So if you actually are using social media last night, then you can clearly feel that the censorship is really increasing and the government tried to control the conversation.
So one part of this story is, you kind of summed it up, is that Dr. Li had been reprimanded by Chinese police after he shared those concerns about the virus with a medical school classmate on WeChat. That scolding, that shutting down of someone trying to tell the truth, is that also part of what's been resonating so strongly among Chinese citizens?
Absolutely. I mean, what he was doing, just, you know, he was being a doctor. He tried to warn his colleagues about this situation. So this is something like anybody who has decency would do. So he wasn't an active type. He was just a normal person, normal doctor with good conscience. So people feel that, you know, this could happen to anybody. Anybody could be punished for just speaking truth just to colleagues.
But as you say, you have never seen a level of this anger kind of just going forth publicly on social media. Can you just give us a sense of how social media in China works, specifically Weibo? Is everything expressed on Weibo by Chinese citizens being monitored and censored by Chinese authorities? How independent is Weibo?
I mean, Weibo is a private company, so they do the censorship according to their own rules, but they also take orders from the Chinese government. So these two aspects of the censorship. Yeah, I mean, I've seen this, you know, the anger is there and the censorship is coming very quickly. I mean, this is a outbreak, a crisis that is affecting almost everybody in China. So, you know, everybody's involved. So
it sounds like some Weibo employees are essentially government bureaucrat light. But, I mean, that can't be everybody. Do you know anything about the people who actually are inside Weibo, who are moderating what they see? And are they becoming more rebellious?
I wouldn't say that they become more rebellious. I mean, I've interviewed people who work as censors for Weibo, former censors. So I would say, you know, that the control over the censors are actually getting tighter. There's more restricted on what they do. For example, they're like a surveillance inside the censorship department of Chinese social media companies. So if you take a screenshot of your computer, that would be monitored by the company and would be punished severely.
Wow. So the censors inside the company are being censored themselves?
Yes, yes.
What kind of dilemma does this current situation present for the Chinese government to censor or not censor when the whole world is watching?
I think about 1 week ago, there are a lot of like local journalists who work for the Chinese media, you know, more commercial media. They did a great job in reporting the virus. They went to Wuhan. So I think at that time, there was a kind of a period that the censorship was not that tight. I think for the central government, they wanted to get the truth too. But then they immediately sense, you know, people are very angry and there are all this outpouring of anger. So then they tried to tighten the control of the media.
So today, I mean, postings about Dr. Li, are they still being censored and being erased?
Yes. I mean, there's still a lot of anger and a lot of censorship. So if you use the social media, you can just clearly feel it.
So I know there's like a long list of terms, search terms that Weibo sifts out, like Winnie the Pooh, often kind of a symbol for Xi Jinping, Tiananmen, obviously, Tank Man. Is coronavirus and Dr. Li now on that list?
Not coronavirus and Dr. Li per se, but a lot of people now they're having a hashtag, you know, I demand free speech, I want free speech. And those phrases are either censored or unsearchable. So the government or Weibo, the company, are taking actions towards people's demand for human rights.
Yachou Wang, a China researcher at Human Rights Watch, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
One thing's for sure about this coronavirus outbreak, it is a global challenge and needs a coordinated global response. Today, U.S. officials pledged up to $100 million in funding for China and the World Health Organization. The U.S. was already engaged in the effort to prevent and contain outbreaks abroad. One of the agencies that's taken the lead is the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In recent years, the CDC has expanded its operations globally precisely to combat these sorts of threats. But as the world's Alana Gordon reports, the agency is also facing some threats of its own.
Here's the thing to know about disease prevention and control. It really doesn't get much public attention when everything seems normal. But when a crisis hits, that's a whole different story. Jennifer Nuzzo is with the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins University. She sees a pattern that dates back to the very beginning of the agency itself.
Many people don't know that the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service, the EIS program, they're the subject of movies often, so they're the disease detectives you often see investigating in movies like Contagion and others. That program was actually started in response to concerns about the Korean War and concerns that there may be a misuse of a biological agent.
Scary stuff. But Nezo says it was this fear of biological warfare that led to the creation of a global powerhouse to combat the spread of illnesses, those U.S. disease detectives who work to identify pathogens and contain outbreaks. And that was just the start for the CDC. Moving into the 1990s, it took on a bigger role. There was HIV, and then
September 11th, 2001.
The 9/11 event really took CDC, you might say, from the traditional 1970s, 80s public health approach to one of the need for emergency global response.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of infectious disease research at the University of Minnesota, and he was called in post-9/11 to work with the CDC on the threat of bioterrorism. During that time, he says the CDC really organized into a single coordinated force, monitoring diseases around the globe. It also expanded its physical presence, with U.S. scientists working all over the world to get ahead of potential biological threats. But many experts say the CDC's real global moment came in the aftermath of a new and deadly illness that emerged in China and spread. SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, infected thousands and killed hundreds of people in 2003. Claire Stanley is a global health security specialist at Georgetown University.
So in SARS, one of the challenges was information sharing. So although cases were detected, information wasn't shared. And so people traveled to different places who were infected. And without that information sharing, cases got out of control. And they didn't know very much about the infection pathways at first. And so there was a lot of secondary healthcare worker infection. And those systems just weren't in place.
That's when the World Health Organization established emergency rules for responding to outbreaks like SARS. It was a wake-up call to national governments to get more coordinated across borders and to prepare for the next big threat. In the last 15 years, the CDC has played a leading role in training disease detectives across the globe and helping local governments build their own centers for disease control. That included China. But Beth Cameron says the agency's efforts had major blind spots. She's a global health expert who's done a lot of work with the CDC. Cameron says the Ebola outbreak in 2014 was a moment of reckoning.
In West Africa, unfortunately, over 11,000 people lost their lives, which occurred in a place that had not seen Ebola before and where there wasn't preparedness programs in place from the U.S. government or others to assist those affected countries.
Cameron says Congress reacted to the Ebola crisis with billions of dollars in new funding. With that, the CDC expanded its efforts, especially in Africa and Asia. And Cameron was in the thick of it. She served on the National Security Council staff and worked with the Obama White House. But then that old pattern kicked in. The panic subsided. The one-time funding for the Ebola outbreak had an expiration date. Cameron says that jeopardized the CDC's global operations.
So that provides uncertainty in countries' ability to prevent, detect, and respond to disease threats. That's countries like Vietnam, Indonesia, India, Burkina Faso, countries like Mali.
Then in 2017, the Trump administration dissolved key leadership posts in global preparedness. The administration also proposed deeper funding cuts for the CDC. But so far, it's been spared by Congress.
The work that was done in those 5 years was great work, but kind of like the scaffolding for a building, if the building doesn't get built brick by brick, in between that scaffolding, it'll fall over.
The emergence of this new coronavirus means we're finding ourselves in yet another moment of more fear, more urgency. The CDC disease detectives are working with others around the globe to coordinate, to strengthen labs. And with that, the agency's own capacity to rapidly respond is once again in the spotlight. The White House recently created a special task force. Cameron and other global health specialists say the key to getting ahead is breaking that cycle of reactivity and cementing those walls, so to speak, before a crisis hits. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Still to come on the show, on Sunday, Switzerland heads to the polls. They're voting on a law that would make it illegal to discriminate based on sexual orientation.
Many Swiss people overrate how modern our country is. It might be rich, but concerning LGBT rights, it's really not modern yet.
That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Say the words Sinn Féin and you might think of the hardline Irish Nationalist Party, a party associated with the terror group, the IRA, in Northern Ireland. But Sinn Féin is now a big player in the Republic of Ireland. Quick geography reminder, that is the independent Ireland on the southern side of the Emerald Isle. For decades, two center-right parties have dominated politics there, but new opinion polls show Sinn Féin in the lead on the eve of a general election tomorrow. I asked The World's Orla Barry in London about this shakeup in Irish politics.
It's a real shock, Marco. Traditionally, as you said, we have these two centre-right parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They're the ones who've been battling it out, sharing power back and forth for the last essentially 100 years since independence in the 1920s from Britain. And to see Sinn Féin come ahead like this in the most recent poll last weekend really took everyone by surprise. These are the highest polling numbers that the party has ever received since entering the Irish Parliament decades ago. It should, by the way, come with a caveat, though, because Sinn Féin often do quite well in polls, and then on election day, their vote often collapses.
Is there a sense that maybe this election will be different? I mean, how has Sinn Féin managed to kind of get to the top of the polls, and who is it appealing to?
A lot of the reason is thanks to the party leader, to Mary Lou MacDonald, because prior to this, the IRA was always closely associated with Sinn Féin. But Mary Lou MacDonald is a very different character. She's a woman who was born in Dublin. She's from a wealthy part of Dublin, well-educated, and a woman, first of all. The traditional Sinn Féin voter has usually been northern. They usually been male, quite nationalist, quite working class. Mary Lou has come in and sort of positioned herself as a much more middle class voter, appealing to people on issues like housing and issues like healthcare. And also, she's been positioning Sinn Féin basically as the alternative to the mainstream parties, as the alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Have a listen to her. She was on the TV the other night in a TV debate.
The theme of this election has emerged as a thirst for change. I'm very clear what that change means. Everywhere that I have gone, people have said to me that they recognise that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, essentially identical parties, have had it all their own way now for almost a century.
So if a party like Sinn Féin gets into government in the Republic of Ireland, I mean, what would that mean for this dream for some people of a united Ireland, bringing together Northern Ireland and the Republic of?
Yeah, it's interesting because Sinn Féin is a very nationalist party. They've always campaigned for a united Ireland. And Mary Lou MacDonald was asked about this on the campaign trail recently, if there would be a referendum on a united Ireland under her watch.
It's a necessity. I mean, I've said very clearly that I believe we should have a border poll within the next 5 years. This shouldn't be written up as some sort of exotic red line from Sinn Féin. This is an absolute necessity. And I have to tell you, I cannot understand political leaders or political parties who refuse to see what is in plain sight, and that is the change is happening. This issue, this needs to be done, and it needs to start now.
So, as she said there, if Sinn Féin get into government, they will push for a referendum to be held within the next 5 years.
So what does this all mean for the current Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar? He was seen as the new face of Ireland, a son of an Indian immigrant, openly gay. Is his time over?
Yeah, and in a sense, that image that you portray of him very much worked for him abroad and perhaps doesn't work as well at home. Mm. So, you know, abroad, he cuts a very fine figure on the international stage. He's articulate, he looks good, he's young, he mixes well with the other European leaders. But back home, there is a sense that he concentrated so much on international affairs and so much on Brexit that he took his eye off the ball when it came to the bread and butter issues, when it came to the issues like housing and rent prices. Anyone who's in Dublin will tell you that rents have gone through the roof. The people felt that he just wasn't taking note of things that were really happening on the ground and the day-to-day problems that people were facing. So while he was doing quite well internationally, maybe it's not going to work so well for him at home.
Well, it's not over until the voters sing, and we'll find out what happens this weekend, I guess. The World's Orla Barry in London. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
People in Switzerland are also going to the polls this weekend. The big question facing voters there, should discrimination based on sexual orientation be a crime? The BBC's Imogen Folks has more on that from Bern.
Welcome to Bern's LGBT office.
In Bern's LGBT campaign office, Anna Rosenwasser, director of the Swiss lesbian organisation, explains why she thinks her country is lagging behind on LGBT rights.
I feel like many Swiss people overrate how modern our country is. It might be rich, but concerning LGBT rights, it's really not modern yet.
We have no laws concerning public discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Anna hopes that will change this weekend when the Swiss vote on whether to make discrimination because of sexual orientation illegal.
In der Schweiz werden Menschen wegen ihrer sexuellen Orientierung diskriminiert.
But when she took part in a televised debate on the issue, Anna faced opposition from Benjamin Fischer of the right-wing Swiss People's Party. He dismissed the new law as an attack on free speech.
We don't even know if jokes about gays will be allowed. We live in a country with freedom of expression. People should be allowed to think and say what they like, even if it's a bit stupid or tasteless. We should be allowed to do it, and we should be able to put up with it.
There is opposition too from some religious groups. Mark Jost of the Swiss Evangelical Alliance fears his church might have to welcome same-sex couples.
Our members, our churches, they see the marriage of a man and a woman as the only couple they want to marry, but also am I free to hire a staff with my sexual ethics.
Supporters of the new law say it's not about peaceful disagreement, but about discrimination and aggression. They point to statistics showing suicide among Switzerland's gay community is 5 times the rate for heterosexual people. This video investigation by Swiss journalists revealed undisguised violence towards gay couples on the streets of Zurich. One attacker even suggests gay people can be cured with a few punches.
Yeah, mit paar Schlag.
And this is why campaigner Jessica Zuber believes freedom of speech must have limits.
Freedom of expression in a liberal democracy actually only goes as far as the individual right to human dignity is being protected.
Opinion polls suggest most voters agree and will back the new law. For Anna Rosenwasser, an important sign that she can be free and safe in her own country to express her identity.
I've dated men for 10 years, so now I have a girlfriend. And we are a cuddly couple, we do hold hands, you know, but there are situations where we will not hold hands in order to feel more safe. And I cannot remember any situation when I've been with a man where I let go of his hand in order to feel more safe.
Anna Rosenwasser ending that report from the BBC's Imogen Folks. You're listening to The World. The U.S. runs the biggest immigration detention system in the world, but California wants no part of it. Many say the system should be destroyed.
It's so important for us to think about how we can tear down the system and not simply to reform it.
A new California law would shut down big migrant detention centers. That story's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The United States runs the largest immigration detention system in the world. It's been growing for years under both Democratic and Republican administrations, but under President Trump, it reached peak capacity. Last summer, 50,000 people were held in detention, including children. California wants no part of this, and a new state law is aimed at shrinking the system. The World's Monica Campbell has our story.
This young woman from Guatemala says she never thought she'd be locked up for so long.
Tengo un año y un mes.
It's been 1 year and 1 month, she says. She's not counting the days at this point, rather the months. We're using her last name only, Vicente, because of the uncertainty of her case.
Yo salí huyendo.
Huyendo.
En la madrugada.
In 2018, Vicente says she fled an abusive partner in Guatemala. He was threatening to kill her, so she ran away in the middle of the night. She put her 3 kids in her sister's care and went north. The plan was to reunite with them eventually in the United States. But when Vicente asked for asylum at the border, U.S. officials took her to a detention center north of Los Angeles, where I talked to her by phone. Immigrants detained for long periods of time isn't new, but under the Trump administration, time spent in detention is getting even longer. Lisa Knox is an immigration lawyer at the firm representing Vicente's case.
I think her case, it really illustrates
how everything is just intentionally more difficult and takes longer in the system that we have under the Trump administration.
Knox also points to another change under Trump when it comes to who is detained. Before, a judge might release someone like Vicente with an ankle monitor and a court date. The idea was she hasn't committed a crime, so why keep her in a jail-like setting? But that's happening less now.
We've seen more and more asylum seekers who, instead of being in detention for a week or two, are spending 4, 5, 6 months in detention.
ICE is also detaining more undocumented immigrants who've lived for years in the U.S. with no criminal history. It's part of the Trump administration's push to detain a wider swath of people. But California is pushing back. A new state law went into effect last month to ban both privately run prisons and immigration detention centers. Grisel Ruiz is a lawyer at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center based in San Francisco. The nonprofit helped push for the new California law.
It's so important for us to think outside of the box and really think about how we can tear down the system and not simply to work within it and work to reform it.
Ruiz points to reports of abuse at detention centers. Government inspectors have described rotten food and unsanitary bathrooms. There are also investigations into several deaths of detainees. 6 people have died in ICE custody since October. And the reports often highlight the high rate of abuse at privately run facilities. One of the biggest private prison companies, the GEO Group, turned down an interview request for the story, but a spokesperson emailed a statement saying that the company is required to meet government standards, but that it plays no role in creating them.
Es un dormitorio de 2 pasillos. En cada pasillo hay 50 camas.
Vicente, the woman in detention from Guatemala, tells me how she sleeps in a bunk bed in a room with 100 other women. She spends up to 22 hours a day inside. She says speaking on the phone with her kids keeps her strong. The other day, she says her older daughter told her, "Don't come home, Mom. I know why you left." Democratic presidential candidates say they want to shrink the number of detention centers. Here's former Vice President Joe Biden speaking at a rally in North Carolina.
Close them down. No. No, 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 no. By the way, we don't need them. We found that when we were in office, in fact, if you decided we finally got things under control, we find us that if you and say you have to report back for a hearing on such and such a date, people show up.
Biden's referring to the fact that immigrants let out of detention with ankle monitors on do tend to show up to their court hearings. But under Trump, trying to shut down immigration detention isn't easy. Just days before the California law went into effect, ICE signed new long-term contracts worth billions of dollars with 3 private prison companies, including the GEO Group. There's now a legal battle over this. ICE didn't respond to interview requests, but ICE officials have criticized initiatives like California's, saying they only make it harder for the agency to do its job.
Just because you're not a criminal alien doesn't mean we shouldn't enforce the law.
Mark Morgan was acting ICE director last year. He spoke to the PBS NewsHour.
And once you get here, if nothing ever happens to you, the pull factor is unbelievable. They're going to keep coming.
ICE also says that if its agents can't detain immigrants in California, they will detain people and open new detention facilities elsewhere. The states of Texas and Louisiana, for example, allow private companies to run detention facilities. Azadeh Shashahani is based in Atlanta with Project South, which advocates for immigrants.
Yeah, I very much hope that other states will follow suit. But the reality is that in the short term, at least, I think the private prison corporations will go to states and regions of the country where they feel that they're going to find the least amount of resistance, and that typically ends up being the U.S. South.
Immigrant rights advocates say they're encouraged, however, to see other states taking similar steps to California's. Illinois just put restrictions on privately run immigration detention, and lawmakers in both Minnesota and New Mexico are also debating similar proposals. For The World, Monica Campbell.
Most of the migrants coming to the U.S. are from Central America. Further south in Venezuela, there's another type of migration crisis, millions fleeing a collapsing economy and political system. You'll recall that Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido was a guest at President Trump's State of the Union earlier this week. Today, Russia made its feelings clear on who should run Venezuela. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is in Caracas, meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Russia's economic and political backing has helped Maduro hang on to power. Jeff Mankoff is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the deputy director of their Russia and Eurasia program.
You know, the Russian energy sector, particularly Rosneft, which is the state-owned Russian energy company, has been doing business in Venezuela for a long time. But because of the U.S. embargo and because of the confrontation between the U.S. and the Maduro government, Venezuela has become more reliant on Russia and on Rosneft, both politically and economically. So now, you know, Rosneft is an increasingly important conduit for Venezuela to export its oil. And for Russia, that's both politically and economically valuable. Venezuela has few other options, so it has to rely on Rosneft for an increasing percentage of its exports, which means that Rosneft can dictate price and is doing so in a way that is very beneficial for the company and for Russia.
So what do you think is on the agenda for the meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Maduro?
I think it has both economic and political implications. You know, economically, to discuss Russian support, which includes not only the exporting of Venezuelan oil, but also investment in production, Russian loans, various other kinds of financial assistance. But also, it's about sending a message to the United States, to Guaido, that Maduro has Russian backing. You know, Lavrov is doing a kind of Western Hemisphere tour this week. He was in Mexico, Cuba, Venezuela. And this comes on the heels of Secretary of State Pompeo visiting several states in the former Soviet Union, Belarus, Ukraine, a couple of the Central Asian states. And so on the Russian side, there's a little bit of a message to Washington that if you want to play around in our backyard, we can play around in your backyard.
Reading the reports on all of this, I mean, the rhetoric about Venezuela seems like a Cold War throwback. The U.S. seeing Russia as a supporter of the socialist proxy Venezuela, Russia seeing U.S. military pressure in this imperialist light. How closely are Russia's and the United States' goals with Venezuela really the same?
Well, they're the same in the sense that they both have ulterior economic motives, but they're pretty diametrically opposed on the political question about whether Maduro stays or goes. You know, the U.S. position is that his reelection was fraudulent, that he's no longer legitimate. The U.S. recognizes Guaido, who was at the State of the Union the other night. Russia's position is this is an internal Venezuelan affair. The U.S. shouldn't be dictating who is and isn't the legitimate president of a foreign country. And it's also standing by Maduro in much the same way that it stood by other authoritarian leaders around the world, like Bashar al-Assad, for instance.
So, Jeff, just help us understand what Putin's endgame is in Venezuela.
You know, it's hard to say. I think with the Russians, there's often a spectrum of acceptable outcomes. On the lower end, it's probably to make as much money off of Maduro's predicament as possible while the getting is good. At the maximum, I think it's to gain kind of a toehold in Venezuela that would allow it to be more influential in a part of the world that the United States does consider its own backyard. I don't think the Russians are going to set up military bases in Venezuela, but you could certainly see scenarios under which you've got Russian private military contractors, a larger diplomatic presence, and Russia kind of using that as a tool to promote a kind of counter U.S. axis in the Western Hemisphere, which, as you noted, would look very similar to what the Soviet Union did for much of the Cold War.
Jeff Mankoff with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you for your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Locusts are swarming over large areas of Africa and Asia. They're spread out over 10 countries, threatening the food supply of millions of people in places like Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. Countries that have been impacted are asking for tens of millions of dollars in international aid to protect the upcoming spring harvest. Without large-scale interventions, the swarms could grow by 500-fold come June. The representative from the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization to Ethiopia, Fatuma Saeed, joins me. What is the situation on the ground? How have the swarms been affecting Ethiopian farmers and herders?
The swarms are unfortunately affecting Ethiopian farmers and pastoralists. The government has been battling to control the swarms since June. They have tried and they have applied all the resources, but now the swarms are increasing. They are very large and the reproduction is high. So the government capacity is very much stretched.
What does locust damage actually look like? Like if you go to a field, what will a swarm of locusts have done to it?
A swarm of locusts, the minute it lands in a field, within hours, it can eat almost everything. To give you an idea, a locust swarm that is as large as 1 square kilometer can eat the equivalent of a food of 35,000 people.
Wow. So the FAO is asking for $76 million from the international community to deal with this. How will that money actually be used?
That is mainly for a rapid upscale of air and ground control, meaning more planes, more flying hours and pesticide to spray, ground team and vehicles to spray, as well as impact assessment on the pasture, farmland and cropland, so that we are also anticipating how to rapidly help these people to recover.
If we look specifically at Somalia, the unstable security situation there means that planes can't be used to spray pesticides, I would imagine. So if locusts know no borders, how are you going to manage the challenge of working in a place like Somalia?
That is a challenge for Somalia. I'm based and I'm the FAO representative to Ethiopia. Every FAO representative is working with the government at our level to do the most we can with the different techniques in the different areas. So in Ethiopia, we are fortunate enough to upscale both air and ground control operation. And we hope by doing so and maximizing the control in those two countries, we will be able to minimize the damage.
Scientists are saying that climate change, unusually wet weather, has made the locust problem worse. How are you looking forward to the future to prevent more swarms?
FAO is always encouraging government to engage in preventive control. Preventive control means that FAO is engaged in the surveillance. We know when the locusts start to gather and form swarms, but while they are not yet flying, but just without the wings. And that's the best time to control. The swarms are much smaller, so that's the best way to control the locusts. It's immediately to react, and government must be equipped to do that far before these swarms start flying. And that's the easy and most efficient way to do it.
Fatima Said, the FAO representative in Ethiopia, speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So the locust factor is up. Fortunately for parts of Australia, the fire factor is down.
Wow, check this out, fans. There's some water here.
Heavy rain hit parts of New South Wales, an enormous relief for residents like Mark Cashin, who's watched as his state has been ravaged by fires. This is from a Facebook video he posted, shot from his car. He's driving down a street that is now flooded.
Yarrandale Road. Hasn't rained like this for a while.
The rain actually put out about a third of the wildfires. Much of New South Wales has suffered from drought for more than 3 years running, conditions that made the bushfires especially bad. Some of them had been burning for more than 2 months. Mark Cashin was driving near the town of Ningun when he came across something that would be worrying in normal times.
Have a look at this. Water, water, water everywhere.
Local authorities are also delighted with the downpour, but now warnings about flooding in cities along the coast. Australia's largest city, Sydney, today recorded its wettest day in more than 15 months. The heavy rains are expected to continue through next week, but a lot more rainfall in the long term is needed to end the drought.
Hope it keeps coming.
Slow and steady. Yeah, we hope so too, Mark. The coronavirus has led to a lot of fear, especially for doctors and other medical workers battling its spread. In China, working conditions for medical professionals are becoming more hazardous. In Hong Kong, the ones at the front lines in the fight are standing up to the authorities. This past week, some medical workers there went on strike. Tim McLaughlin is a Hong Kong-based contributing writer for The Atlantic magazine and has been following the strike. Tim, what were the strikers actually demanding?
The big two were, one, a closure of the border between Hong Kong and mainland China. And then the second one was a quarantine period for Hong Kong residents or permanent residents of Hong Kong or Hong Kong citizens who are returning from the mainland to be put on a quarantine period of 14 days, which they're using in a lot of other countries. And those were the two big ones that they were demanding during the strike.
And how have Hong Kong authorities responded? And why did the strike conclude today?
The government will not admit it, I don't think, ever. But this strike, in terms of effectiveness, it didn't force a full closure of the border, but certainly effective in getting the demand met about the quarantine period and also having the government drastically reduce the number of crossing points that are open between the mainland and Hong Kong. So they took a vote and very slim margin decided to discontinue it. It had been going on for 5 days. Overall, like a pretty good show of force from the new organized labor front here, and also definitely pushed the government, whether or not the government will admit that, but certainly seemed to get some results.
What did we hear from the chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, on this? How did she respond?
She called a kind of hasty press conference a few days ago where she did decide to close more border points, put in more stringent checks. And again, didn't say it was from political pressure, didn't say that it came from the union. However, if you look at the timeline, you look at what was going on, it's tough to think that they didn't have an impact. And also, I should say that there's huge public support for the strike and for the border closure. So there was about 80% of people polled in a recent survey were in favor of closing the border entirely, and 61% of people polled in a survey were in favor of the medical strike. So huge popular support between both of those issues.
So as you said, the pro-democracy protests last summer kind of blasted some energy into Hong Kong's labor movement. What did union organization look like in Hong Kong before the protests, and how has labor solidarity evolved over the past year?
Hong Kong is kind of a unique situation. You know, the pro-democracy movement gave rise to around 24 unions that have been formed end of last year into this year, where people realize that if they can organize labor, if they can hold strikes, it's kind of a new tactic rather than just protesting on the street, where they can kind of force change or try to drive their agenda in a new way that they haven't been doing before. And there's been a huge interest, huge turnout for these unions. January 1st, we saw like a huge drive to get people to sign up. So like I said, about 24 and counting that have formed recently, and I imagine that number will go up.
I mean, given the semi-autonomous status of Hong Kong, aren't strikers taking a risk?
There absolutely is a risk here. You know, I think the institutions in Hong Kong, the civil service, the hospital authority, the hospitals themselves, nothing has been spared from the protest movement. It is very clear that there's been retaliation for people having certain political positions or for holding certain views on the pro-democracy movement. They could lose their jobs, that they could lose promotions, that all that kind of stuff could have happened. So a lot of people don't want to use their full names to be identified, but here's what a medical worker, Sam Chan, told me about why he was out striking.
This may sacrifice our career because we expect the government to punish us in the future. But now we are so united, so I think we can force the government to close the border.
Right, but with the end of the strike, a total border shutdown was not in the cards. So Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, said that would be discriminatory. What did medical workers tell you about a total border shutdown?
A lot of voices out there, obviously thousands of people. The strikers that I spoke to generally disagreed with Carrie Lam's assessment on it being a discriminatory measure. Here's a physiotherapist and told me about what he thought.
We're not really discriminatory. Like, we're just trying to like prevent the virus from coming in. So actually, like, the virus has no ratio, like no racism against anything, right? So it's actually discriminate against the virus only, not the people.
Right. So looking at the science and not the identity. So the strike is now over, but obviously the concerns about coronavirus remain. What are the before and after shots? What has changed in Hong Kong since the coronavirus alert? What have you seen?
Yeah. You know, you see a lot of the distrust in the government playing out on the streets now. You see panic buying, 9,000, 10,000 people waiting in line to buy masks. You see runs on toilet paper and tissues in the last few days. The supermarket's getting totally cleaned out. Not a lot of trust in the government, and certainly what the government's been doing so far, not reassuring a lot of people that they shouldn't be in panic mode. Part of that is also goes back to 2003, a lot of memories of the SARS epidemic that hit Hong Kong extremely hard. So, you know, where other countries or other territories might be dealing with the new coronavirus, there's a lot of history in Hong Kong over how bad these things can get. You know, almost 300 people died that year. So a lot of memories that people still hang on to and are still aware of.
Tim McLaughlin, a Hong Kong-based contributing writer for The Atlantic magazine. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And finally today, the same way Vincent van Gogh had his brushes and oil paint, the prominent Malian musician Balake Sissoko had his kora. That's Sissoko on his custom-built kora with electronic pickups. The kora is a harp-like instrument with a long neck and up to 24 strings. In West Africa, it's a crucial part of culture.
People spend their entire lives learning how to build the instruments and play the instruments.
That's Cullen Strawn, director for the arts at Old Dominion University in Virginia.
And when an accomplished musician finds an instrument that they really connect with, it's very special and irreplaceable.
But when Sissoko returned to his home in Paris this week after a tour in the U.S., he found his cherished instrument broken into pieces. Sissoko described the moment he opened his case.
En fait, là, j'avais une tournée.
I was on a tour of the United States, and on Sunday I took a night flight back to France. And as I was jet-lagged, I didn't realize straight away. I got some sleep, and then because I needed to rehearse, I opened the box and saw a note there saying it had been examined.
Balake Sissoko says he found a note inside the case written in Spanish on an official TSA baggage inspection form. In a photo posted on Facebook by his manager, you can see the neck ripped from the body and the strings yanked off.
And it's the second time this has happened to me. I broke one instrument 15 years ago, but this time the kora was dismantled, not just damaged. And that made me so angry.
The TSA says it never opened the case because no alarms were triggered. Whatever the cause, Cullen Strawn says when a top player like Sissoko loses an instrument, it's devastating. Their instrument is practically another human limb.
So to lose something like that, it really is to lose part of themselves.
Music there from Balake Sissoko, wishing his instrument salvation soon. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.